It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning again, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk. Kirk, did you ever say bless you in class to somebody before?
All the time. I still say it.
Well, that's actually landed a student in Georgia in hot water. Can you believe that? A professor has banned a college student from saying, or banned all college students, I should say, from saying bless you while in class. This from CBS Atlanta. One professor at the College of Coastal Georgia has banned students from saying bless you in his class. The reports are that the assistant professor of chemistry at the College of Coastal Georgia pointed out his 6 rules on behavior on his introductory physics class syllabus. And according to number 6, under the behavioral deduction section of the syllabus, students' grades will be lowered for saying bless you. He goes on to explain, we are taught that it is polite to say bless you when someone sneezes. However, if you say this while I am talking, it is not polite. It is very rude. The professor states that a student may be deducted up to 15% of their final grade for any student that disrupts his class. He goes on to say in the syllabus that saying bless you may result in an immediate 1% grade deduction for each occurrence. And he says, especially egregious behavior, I guess maybe saying bless you too loudly or
maybe God bless you.
God bless you, yes. could result in expulsion from the class, withdrawal from the course, and disciplinary action from the college. And last week, a high school senior in another class in Tennessee, another state, was suspended after breaking a class rule saying bless you after a classmate sneezed.
Is this some sort of nationwide trend that we're seeing?
I guess so. This is a trend.
Well, I can see the guy, you said it's a physics class that
yes.
he's teaching.
Yes.
Perhaps there should be a more scientific response to someone
right.
else sneezing, such as please keep the expulsion of your germs at a particular velocity to a minimum or something.
Yes,
I don't know.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
Like some sort of formulaic approach to the
right.
whole thing. But, you know, interestingly, what about the person that sneezes? Is that person going to get a deduction? Because it's inciting another person to violate the same rules.
To say bless
it's like
you.
A conspiracy.
Right,
it
right.
It could be, if it was an intentional sneeze.
It could
I
be
suppose.
A conspiracy.
But what about a reckless
so
sneeze?
That would be sort of an aiding and abetting
aiding and abetting,
situation.
Yes, or promoting the violation of law by another through your own action.
Yeah, boy, this is just
what
so
if? What if you failed to take appropriate allergy and or cold medication to, you know, appropriately prevent yourself from sneezing?
So that could be negligence, right?
It could be negligence. It could also be willful. If you knew that you were prone to sneeze
right.
and you didn't take all the action necessary to stop you from sneezing and you're putting somebody else in harm's way, well, that could also be seen as contributory recklessness or
exactly.
negligence.
Exactly. So this is a very serious offense, I think.
But seriously, do you think the guy is a loony or do you think that he's just quirky?
I don't know because it's happened in other states.
It doesn't
too,
appear to be based on the word bless, by the way. It doesn't seem like that's – it just seems like one of those rules. I don't know. Maybe it is.
Well, let me
– He doesn't cite the reason for it.
Let's go to Tennessee, shall
okay,
we?
Okay, let's go to Tennessee.
All right. CBS – Charlotte, I don't know why it's Charlotte. I would presume that's North Carolina, not Tennessee. But in any event, a high school student was allegedly suspended after breaking a class rule of saying bless you after a classmate sneezed. Kendra Turner, a senior at Dyer County High School, said bless you to her classmate who sneezed, and the teacher told her that the term was for church.
Oh.
She said that we're
that
not...
That way.
Yeah. She said we're not going to have godly speaking in her class, and that's when I said we have a constitutional right. When she defended her actions, the teacher told Turner to see an administrator. The student said that she had to finish a class period in-school suspension. The girl's parents were told by school leaders that their daughter shouted, bless you. Maybe that would be egregious,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a little... I can see how that... And in fact, I can remember back in high
bless
school.
Bless you!
Yeah, everybody all at once shouts, bless you!
Across the room. It, yeah,
it bless
was,
you!
She said that it was a classroom distraction. School officials told their parents Tuesday the teacher claimed that their daughter was aggressive and disruptive. Okay, so aggressive and disruptive is one thing.
Little bit different than
but
this, may the Lord bless you and keep you.
Right, but this seems more to be to be targeting the content of speech.
Well, it would appear that way.
Rather than the volume of one's
speech.
And
that is on very shaky ground.
It is, because you know, as you and I have talked about before, and we don't do school law or education law. However, the Constitution is pretty clear. Now, you have a lesser protections while you're in the school because you can't be disruptive in a classroom.
Right.
But you still have certain limited free speech rights.
Right. Well, why do people say bless you to begin with? Let's talk about that, because it's actually very interesting, the history.
It is interesting. I think because, well, isn't it? I mean,
I think it goes
back to, because you're trying to,
like, the medieval times when, well, you're thinking that there's some sort of evil spirit that's inside of you that's forcing you to expel
to
spit or something.
Yes,
like that. I don't know what it is, but you know that you're possessed by some sort of cold or allergy demon.
But it's a pleasantry.
It's a pleasantry. It's one of those things like good morning,
Except
which doesn't necessarily have any religious content. Although if you extrapolate the history behind saying good morning or good evening, I suppose that there's some sort of
there could be some religious.
You know, why are you wishing somebody a good morning? Well, it's implied that by doing so, it results in having a good morning. And where does that come from? Do you have the power to make somebody have a good morning by simply saying it? The word is the law, which is the,
that's
very
biblical. Yes, God is in charge of that and is saying whether you're going to have a good morning.
I'm the conduit. I'm helping you have a good morning by saying it, and therefore the Spirit of the Lord will come from me and to you, and you'll have a great morning and pleasant breakfast and all those other things.
Well, and I would just suggest that perhaps these schools that are doing this and expelling students for saying that, I mean, schools are often, at least public schools, are connected to the government in a way, right? So we're talking about speech and the government, at least in a way, at these public schools, regulating one's speech. If we're talking about that, I think that these professors who are doing this might want to be a little bit careful to not get themselves
into hot
water.
And I would think that
the
controversy, usually when we see a controversy in this type of area, it's because one student says, bless you, and another student says, I don't like that, because I've been raised to not say things like that. And then the teacher, trying to maintain the decorum and control over the classroom, has to have some sort of intervention to stop people from quibbling over something, frankly, stupid.
Right.
But the thing that is a little surprising about this is that the source or the root of the controversy comes directly from the teacher in two separate cases.
Yes.
Is there some sort of God haters club out there?
I don't know.
That teachers are ascribing to? Is there a blog or something?
There might be a blog.
Don't say
we'll
bless
have
you.
To look. We'll have to look at that.
But it's one of, I honestly, Casey, it's just one of those things that people say, and I seriously doubt.
Do atheists get offended when you say bless you?
I can't imagine.
I can't imagine either.
And when I say bless you, it's just a nicety. It doesn't mean that I'm actually thinking about God or some spirit, coming down from heaven to ward away evil germs.
Right, but
That's not the thought.
That's
process.
Not the thought.
It's just a reaction.
It is.
Someone sneezes, you just say bless you. You don't think bless you and all these things.
Well, and when
let me get the holy water out.
Yes, and when you're thinking about this, it would be one thing, obviously, and we all know that a school can't, sponsor a religion, at least a public school can't go out and, force people into prayer and things like that. And, we get into a whole separation of church and state debate and all of that goes on. But when you're talking about an actual student who's saying, a student in the school who's saying bless you to another student, to go that far and to somehow suggest that that's inappropriate in some way, I think is ridiculous and really has no merit.
Well, what happens? It ends up being national news, and you and I end up talking about it on our radio show.
Yes.
And
well, so thank you for them giving us
out of control?
A radio topic. Well, Kirk, I just wanted to get into this briefly, but this is, did you know that pocket dialing is becoming a big problem for certain Wisconsin police departments?
Sure.
In CBS 58 ran a story, they're practically glued to our hips, smartphones, always connecting even when we don't mean it. But what happens when that misdial is sent to a 911 dispatcher who's fielding emergencies and unsure if there's a danger or simply carelessness on the other side? It's happening every single day at the Germantown Police Department.
Well, why only in Germantown?
I don't know. But the
it's probably everywhere.
It's probably everywhere, yeah. But Germantown specifically is pointing it out. The lieutenant said, we had 15 of those cell phone 911 calls, and 12 of those 15 were actually pocket dial calls. That was just on one day. The situation has left an already strapped department with even fewer people to respond to the real problems. Lieutenant says, we can't just not respond to the call. We still have to go make sure everything is okay because we don't know if someone is in trouble or in need of our services. Oftentimes, because cell phones coordinates aren't exact, police can be sent on a wild goose hunt. So,
well, just I think it's just something that goes with the territory when you have this kind of technology that does all the thinking for you.
Yes.
You know, if you were to intentionally dial 911, we've seen this before. In fact, I think a couple of years ago, we talked about a story where someone dialed 911 to ask if they could get a ride to the liquor store.
Oh, yes.
Because the guy...
You get in trouble for that.
You get in trouble for that if you're deliberately misusing 911. That's a crime, actually, in most jurisdictions. So then you have to ask the question... You know, we're very good at extrapolating these things beyond
yes.
all reason, but
yes.
you know, is it theoretically possible that somebody has a duty to not dial 911? On most smartphones, you have the capability. I mean, I know with my iPhone, before I put it in my pocket, you simply, you know, click the thing that makes it so your screen isn't active. You just turn it off
right.
so the screen's off.
Right.
Then you're not going to pocket dial.
Right.
It's not going to happen. And you have to swipe or something like that. And then most phones also are enabled with the capability to make it so you have to put a code in or something like that, which is not only for keeping the privacy of the content of your phone to yourself, but also so you don't pocket dial.
But it's a little weird. How do you pocket dial 911? I mean, isn't that pretty specific?
It does seem odd.
I mean, unless you have 911 in your contacts or something like
right,
that.
Right, like you're dialing it all the time.
Yeah, yeah, which is a little weird. But in any event, it's apparently a problem. All right, you're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We will be back in just a moment.
Now, back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL. Bad boys, what you want?
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk. You know, Casey, just before we get into the next topic, I wondered if you noticed over the course of the last week, there were a couple of stories that caught my eye. One was the shooting range in Arizona where a 9-year-old girl was
yes.
being taught how to shoot an Uzi
yes.
Submachine gun. And unfortunate and gruesome incident. First, you might ask, why is a 9-year-old being taught how to shoot a submachine gun? Well, that's not
yeah.
that's a question that's open for debate. But you know, this was on a shooting range, supposedly in a controlled environment, and the instructor there was showing the 9-year-old girl how to shoot the weapon. And you know, he's a veteran safety instructor. And first he shows her how to shoot a single shot, and then he said, okay, now we're going to go on fully automatic. And there, because she's 9 years old, I suppose, she was unable to control the recoil, and the Uzi basically went up over her head and ended up shooting the instructor in the head and killing him.
Ooh.
And hot on the heels of that, I think earlier this week, there was a TV camera crew member for the show Cops. You've seen the show Cops,
oh, yes.
right?
Yes.
And I've often wondered, wow, these cameramen are, you know, following the cops into harm's way oftentimes. And I've seen episodes where they're chasing a naked guy through the back alley and, you know,
yeah.
the guy twists his ankle or something like that. Well, apparently for the first time in the long history of this show, a cameraman was killed by a stray bullet that actually was friendly fire from a police officer involved in
oh
a shooting incident. So right within 1 week, we've got two examples of things gone wrong.
Right.
Now, they're a little different in the sense that, on the one hand, the why are you letting a 9-year-old girl have an Uzi in her hand when you know that that's highly dangerous activity that could result in somebody getting shot?
Yeah,
you know,
especially when you're not strong enough to handle
it. Right, exactly. And of course, that's raised a lot of controversy in relation to whether the parents bear any responsibility for that, or whether or not there should be age limits on certain gun ranges and things like that, or whether or not, you know, then it raises the whole issue about why we have these ranges where you can shoot automatic weapons when it's absolutely illegal to fire them in any other context whatsoever.
Right.
We don't even have most of our law enforcement agencies packing that kind of firepower. But interestingly enough, the situation with the crew member on Cops, you know, I've thought through the years that something like that is bound to happen sooner or later, and it's just the nature of the show. And I think that's why we watch it. It's one of the reasons that we watch it anyway, is that
it's like a car chase.
It's a fascination.
Yeah.
You know, it's the same reason that we watched O.J. Simpson,
exactly.
You know, in the white Bronco.
Right.
Have you noticed that there aren't any white Broncos around? Well, they stopped making Broncos for one thing, but, you know, white was like the most unpopular color of Broncos after the
I can imagine O.J. that Simpson didn't really help set. That wasn't a really good
not
ad
an advertising pitch.
Yeah, so that was a good
sort of like the Michael Jackson Pepsi Cola thing, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. Well, Kirk, this is something that you and I have talked about before, and there was a situation in Milwaukee. You remember when we talked about this concertina beer hall, that there was a shooting there where the owner, Andy Kachansky, fatally shot a suspect and wounded another when they entered his establishment? Well, on the day that he planned to call a key witness in the homicide trial, this according to the Journal Sentinel, a prosecutor on Thursday, this past Thursday, warned the judge that Milwaukee County Sheriff David Clark had issued a news release criticizing a plea bargain with the witness, and that Clark's claim had been discussed on at least two talk radio programs this week.
Now three.
Yeah, well, I guess now three. The judge then began the proceedings by asking jurors if they'd heard or seen anything about the release from, quote, our sheriff, end quote. The prosecutor said that Clark's release contained inaccurate information and omitted the fact that the defendant had agreed to testify against a co-actor. The case involved the attempted robbery last summer of Kachansky's Concertina Beer Hall in Milwaukee that resulted in the owner fatally shooting one suspect and wounding another. A third man is on trial for felony murder. Clark supported Kachansky, who was not charged in the shooting, and called for the faster return of guns seized from lawful shooters. The wounded suspect, Jose Munoz, had also faced felony murder charges but agreed to plead guilty to second-degree reckless homicide. And in advance of Munoz's scheduled sentencing on Thursday, Clark on Thursday put out a news release titled, Watered Down Charge in Exchange for Plea Bargain Rears Its Ugly Head Again. He said in the release, how is this justice for the patrons and tavern owner who were terrorized that day? Munoz's sentencing, though, had been postponed until after he testified against Joel Rivera, the third suspect in the Kachansky robbery, as a condition of his plea agreement with prosecutors. If convicted of felony murder as part of the armed robbery attempt, Munoz could have faced a much longer sentence than the maximum for the reduced charge of second-degree reckless homicide. In warning the circuit court judge about the release Thursday morning, the assistant DA called it full of misleading and inaccurate information put out by the sheriff without any knowledge of this case. So this is another example of where you have a sheriff intervening in plea negotiations.
Let me just point out that if Clark were an attorney involved in the case in some way, representing an individual, he would lose his law license if he were to put out any kind of, and the law is, the rule of ethics that relates to this particular issue is that an attorney cannot issue any kind of news or public statement that has a reasonable chance of affecting the outcome. And that's clearly what this is designed to do. Now, Sheriff Clark is not an attorney practicing law, but he's, you know, attempting to influence the process. The timing is, I wouldn't say suspect. It's obvious.
It's obvious.
And that's manipulation of the court system. Now, we all have a right. Anybody has the right. And I'd say even more so if you're not directly involved with the case, to state an opinion based on facts. But then, you know, journalistically and, you know, in a sense that we have a responsibility. And then, of course, it's if it's published in a journalistic source, there is another buffer zone there, that being those who publish such things, that have a responsibility for making sure that the content of the speech here, or the free speech, is accurate and doesn't damage or harm the legal system. But if we go back to a lot of situations throughout our nation's history, we can go back to when the Watergate scandal was breaking. There was a huge tension between the public's right to know about where the investigation was and where it was going versus the public knowing such facts that could impact the investigation itself. And there's that tension there. Now, I don't really have a problem with Clark stating an opinion regarding what's publicly available and the idea that there could be and perhaps should be some public disagreement about a wrongdoer getting a sweet deal. And that's basically the gist of it. And I think that's something that a lot of people are interested in when that happens.
Well, he is going down on a homicide charge.
He is going down on a homicide charge, but, it's a better deal than he may have otherwise received. Now, the problem is, and the reason I don't have a huge issue with the fact that it's being exposed, it's perhaps a bit irresponsible, but bearing in mind that there are no legal restrictions on what a person, including a sheriff, can put in a paper if he writes an article, as long as he's not an attorney.
That's right.
That's what newspapers are for exposing things, exposing ideas. And I will tell you that I generally have a problem with the way that testimony like this comes about, and you and I have both seen this in court, where it's incentivized. Somebody has a reason to testify a particular way, and in the adversarial process, where it's the defense versus the prosecution, and the prosecution has that special power to grant favors for those who need them, is something that continues to infiltrate our criminal justice system, even in our modern era where such things are supposed to have been extinguished.
Absolutely.
And where a prosecutor says that, okay, in exchange for your quote-unquote truthful testimony, we're going to make things easier for you. That creates a problem within our system, because when you make that offer, the perception from anybody who has the ability to help the prosecutor, it wouldn't take a rocket scientist or even a brain surgeon to understand what the prosecutor wants in that situation. You don't have to be a genius.
Right.
Somebody else is on trial for something. You are in trouble. The prosecutor says, testify, quote, truthfully, and I will do you a favor. Is it a mystery about what you're supposed to say?
No, it's not. I think, though, what Sheriff Clark is getting at is not your understandable concern about informant testimony and offering, giving deals for people to rat out each other, but rather is about this whole notion of being soft on crime, and somehow this is a soft on crime example without knowing the facts of the case. And I think that's
I agree with that.
I think that's what the assistant DA was pointing at, which is
correct.
Look, he's talking about how this is a sweet deal. This has a very real chance of impacting a jury if jurors know about this, and God knows that he puts out these press releases all the time without knowing the specific facts of the case. Unless I'm wrong, I don't believe that he was involved in this case in terms of investigating the case. Maybe he was, but I don't believe he was.
Well, if he was, he shouldn't be revealing details
right,
about
exactly.
it. That's a whole separate issue.
All right. Well, we do have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear.
All right, Kirk. So there's a big debate that's going on right now about body cameras on police,
yes.
Whether it's a good idea, whether it's a bad idea. And a lot of this has stemmed from the fatal shooting of this apparently unarmed teenager, Michael Brown, in Ferguson, Missouri. That has put this technology in the public eye, and there are reports that say that police agencies have seen lower rates of force and citizen complaints after body cameras were put on officers. This is according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Milwaukee tested 5 models of body cameras on city streets last year, and the police department plans to get 50 cameras for a pilot program within the 1,800-member department next year. For some who have marched in Milwaukee in solidarity with Ferguson, it's not soon enough, but the process takes time, Mayor Tom Barrett said. There are issues that can be dealt with, but it's not as easy as just turning on a switch, he said. Although criminal justice and civil liberties experts acknowledge the benefits of body cameras, they also warn of practical considerations: how the technology would be implemented, what policies would govern it, and how it could unintentionally widen the divide between officers and the communities they serve. An update on the body camera pilot program and discussion about the department's dashboard camera policy are expected at the next Milwaukee Fire and Police Commission meeting in September. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when, said the commission director of body cameras. So this has become, and they go on and on and talk about the upside and the downside to body cameras. Now,
I don't see the downside at all.
You know, I don't exactly see it either. I suppose you could make a civil libertarian argument that, you know, this is another example of having cameras everywhere and having people who are recording these things.
Yeah, but I'm finding that argument weaker and weaker as time goes on. Because
we're being recorded so much
anyway.
It's
a function of our society, and it's true that it's becoming more Big Brother-ish. But and I suppose one might say, well, this is the government then going around.
It is.
You know, but if what's wrong... I would rather have documentation of what the police officer's eyes are seeing, because that's anything the officer's looking at. I mean, that's the government too, right?
Right.
So if they're peeking in
Big
windows, or they're looking
right
across the street, or they're focusing their attention on somebody, well, that's...
And you can always misuse this type of technology too.
Well, sure, but but yes, it could be used in such a way to capture things that you're not supposed to be looking at, I suppose.
Right.
But here's the thing. This is one of those tools that, in my mind, has the potential to serve an incredible function that would... And unfortunately, we have situations where an officer's integrity and honesty comes into question unless we have documentation to show to the best, you know, the best that we can anyway. And there are issues, I suppose, that relate to whether or not a camera actually captures the experience of whatever is happening. It obviously can't capture every fact as to what's going on. It may not capture a threat that's perceived from outside of the field of the camera. It may appear to paint an incorrect picture because of the limitations on that. However, the basic idea that when an officer is out there engaging in activity with our community, we hope and trust that that's being done within the bounds of the law. This is a way for officers to prove that they did. So it not only provides that theoretically objective evidence of that fact, but also is an encouragement for them to do so. I know that one of the things that we all fear, and I hear this from people occasionally, that are pulled over by a police officer, and even if they've done nothing wrong, there is this inherent worry that the officer is going to not be an honest cop. I mean, isn't that something that we've we've got as, you know, part of our suspicions about, well, the officer's going to plant drugs in my car, or he's going to say that I ran, or he's going to say whatever. And, you know, it's something that we hope doesn't happen that often. But of course, there are examples of those types of things happening.
Right.
The use of this type of technology, in my mind, also helps clarify a lot of issues where, and we always have situations where officers have one version of events, the perp has another version of events. Sometimes you and I are left to sort that out and figure out who's telling the truth. And one thing that aids us in that process is something like video documentation on a body camera.
And I think the only worry that people would have is that right now, you're right, that we have cameras in many, many different places. But we don't have cameras everywhere. This is going to make it so that we have cameras essentially everywhere. And with the...
Everywhere cops are.
Everywhere cops are. But what I'm saying is, even further than that, you've heard about the Google glasses, right? Those things. People are getting those now. They're buying those. And so you almost can't tell, and I suspect within a couple of years you won't be able to tell, whether somebody's wearing just normal reading glasses or whether they're wearing a camera and the glasses.
I don't know. I know. Are
it's kind of freaky.
Are you a big fan of Sarah Silverman? I am.
Sure, sure.
Yeah, yes. Well, yesterday, you know, I follow her Facebook thing.
Yes.
This was hilarious. Yesterday, she was outside of a Starbucks, and there was a man that had a particularly hirsute derriere.
Oh.
That was exposed, you know, the old...
How
can we say it politely on the radio?
A plumber situation?
Yeah, where you could see more than you're supposed to see from behind when the person's sitting at their table. You know,
I gotcha.
A portion of the body normally covered was exposed, and it was a particularly extreme example of of what we hope to avoid with our eyes. Well, she took a picture of it. complete stranger through the window.
With a camera or with her glasses?
With her phone.
With her iPhone.
With her phone.
Or maybe.
So you can see her reflection in the Starbucks window and the well-framed and exposed...
I don't know.
Behind
exactly.
of the man sitting at the table.
Yeah.
And she sent it out to the entire world. By the time I got the Facebook post, there had already been like 8,000 likes on it, you know.
Well,
my point is this. Anybody walking down the street doing anything, we've all got these phones that have cameras. You could be walking down the street
exactly.
with it, you know, on video mode or whatever. And there's really no limitation or restriction on taking those. And if you happen to be sloppy in public, someone might take a picture of you and post it to the entire world.
Yeah, and I understand the argument on the side of let's... And I certainly agree with, in many ways, the argument that sunlight is the best disinfectant and that we want these types of interactions recorded so that we know what the truth is. I'm all for that. I'm all for the truth. And in addition to that, there have been arguments in the past when, particularly when the Miranda decision came down and when there were debates after that about whether these Miranda interrogations ought to be recorded or not. Some officers having a little bit of pushback on that for various different reasons.
Oh, I'll tell you one main reason that all came about is because I could theoretically read you your Miranda warnings word for word, legally correct, legally accurate, the required information, but I could make it sound like you should not be, invoking your rights. By how I say it,
the tone of the voice, your expressions,
the context, and
yes.
you know, and there's unfortunately nothing wrong with this sort of maneuver where I say, Mr. Hoff, I'm sure you know why we've brought you in. I would really like to get your side of the story here because the way it stands right now, it's a bit of a mystery as to what's going on. I'd like to tell you what the complainant is saying, but unfortunately, I can't give you that information that I know you want to know until we get rid of this formality that we have to get through. So I've got to read you these rights. You know, the department makes me do it.
These lawyers make me do it.
We've got this card. If I don't do it, they'll say I beat it out of you or something like that. And of course, I'm not going to do that. So this is just to protect you and to protect me. And, you know, these are the kinds of things we got to do. I'm sure you've heard about it before. But anyway, let's just get through this part.
Yeah.
You do have the right to remain silent, of course.
You know, go on and on.
And the gist of it is, you know, there's a carrot being dangled in front of you, which is there's bad information about you out there. You have a chance to convince me that it's incorrect, but first you got to get rid of all these rights in order for me to have the chance to... Now, let me say this. If the police have you in custody and they're already asking you questions, odds are it doesn't matter what you're going to say because they're either not going to believe you or you're going to put your foot in your mouth by corroborating something or saying something that you know that's taken out of context. So that's why these recordings of those types of interrogation situations are critical to make sure that that type of practice, although legal, can be exposed and that can become the subject of not only potential litigation but an understanding as to how the person was thinking and what was going on before they said something stupid.
And I agree with that. And the flip side of that is, so that's in an interrogation context, usually in a police department, usually in an interrogation room. Now we're talking about everywhere, out on the streets, wherever you are, whenever you are there, and whenever somebody's looking at you because we have these glasses. In fact, in the story that I printed, there's actually an officer that has a little camera on his glasses. So he didn't even have to you know, point it or anything like that. It's just what he's seeing at all times. So I suppose that's a good thing. On the other hand, that can be something that can be misused. We've seen the cell phone data that's been gathered by the government, right? By the people at the NSA. And it has been misused. And I don't think there's any really dispute that it's been misused. We might agree that it should be used for that purpose, but it wasn't the intended purpose.
Here's the only other thing I would say. At least as things stand right now in our society, there are people, believe it or not, out there, I'm thinking about becoming one myself, that are disconnected by choice from technology. You don't have to have a smartphone if you don't want one. You don't have to have surveillance inside your house for other people to see. You don't have to mount cameras everywhere if you don't want to. Right. But when it comes down to the government walking around with cameras, then it becomes something where, you know, your normal everyday interaction, you can't be disconnected. You don't have that choice anymore. And I guess that
And is that a reasonable expectation of privacy? So we'll talk about this, I'm sure, in many more shows to come, but we have to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. Kirk actually had to leave a little bit early today, so I'm taking over the final segment. There was a story out of Madison, and actually out of Dane County, I should say, where the former Dane County Sheriff's Deputy, or a former Dane County Sheriff's Deputy, was arrested for the alleged murder of his wife and sister-in-law, according to Fitchburg Police. This is from the Wisconsin State Journal. Ashley Steele, 39 years old, and Casey Tollefsbull, 38, were the victims of a double homicide at the Steele's home on the Friday following. The Steele's had been married for 16 years, and Andy Steele, 39, was diagnosed in June, very sad, with ALS, and he retired from the sheriff's office. Ashley Steele began raising money in a campaign called Tough as Steel, taking down ALS for her husband's upcoming care needs through a website called Give Forward. And as of Friday, nearly a third of their goal of $75,000 had been raised through 257 individual donations. So, according to the website, Andy and Ashley Steele met when they were 12 years old in Michigan and attended college together at UW-Madison. They got married after graduation, and Steele went to work for the sheriff's office. Ashley Steele worked for a financial institution until the couple had their own children, their two children, then went back to work as a preschool teacher. So this is just a very sad situation, and obviously we don't know the facts of this yet. We don't know exactly what's going on with this yet, but if the allegations are true, then certainly this is a tragedy all around. There's another story that's been sort of making the rounds about the one of the attorney general candidates in Wisconsin, and that happens to be Susan Happ, who's the district attorney in Jefferson County and is running for the Wisconsin attorney general position. The reason that she's being criticized by some is because she used to be a criminal defense attorney, and not just for that, but rather for her representation of somebody in that role as a defense attorney, somebody who was charged with some child sex crimes and actually convicted of those. And this individual had apparently admitted to molesting children and was originally charged with crimes, according to this story, that could carry up to 220 years in terms of a sentence. And Happ asked that the her client get 10 to 12 years in prison. He was, according to this story, 60 years old at the time when he was charged in April of 2000 with 5 counts of sexually molesting children at his wife's in-home daycare in Palmyra, Wisconsin. And according to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's coverage, he had admitted in a taped statement that he had molested 4 children in the past 6 months. Now, according to the story, then defense attorney Happ tried to get the charges dismissed, and I presume that was essentially a motion in some way to get those charges dismissed. And that's what happens all the time. I mean, defense attorneys fight for their clients. And then he ended up, the defendant ended up pleading guilty or no contest to 7 of the 9 counts of first-degree sexual assault of a child. And there was a plea deal that was struck where the state would not recommend a number of years, but would make clear that the defendant should never get out. And even with Mattson admitting to the offenses, Happ, I think, was doing her job in terms of advocating for her client. And so one of the, they took a quote from her out of the transcript of the proceedings where she said that he is not what society or the law defines as a predator. And she talks about how he was convicted of crimes of opportunity and that these children were in the home. And so the whole article that that I found and the whole criticism of her is that essentially that she said that he wasn't what society or the law defines as a predator, at least according to the transcript. And I think this is an unfortunate attack on her because, and I take particular offense to this because I am a defense attorney as well. She's now a prosecutor, but used to be a defense attorney. And defense attorneys, what they do is they represent clients. I mean, this is not this is something that is normal and is in fact a constitutional duty to defend your clients who are charged with crimes. That's the way that the Constitution would have it. That's the whole point of the Sixth Amendment to the United States Constitution. And whether somebody disagrees with the choice of words that she uses or not, just because somebody is representing somebody accused of a crime or somebody who's been convicted of a crime certainly doesn't mean that the defense lawyer agrees with the crime that was committed, but rather that they have a duty to defend that person. When our former president, John Adams, represented British soldiers accused in the Boston Massacre incident, that was something that was extremely unpopular for him to do. And in fact, that was something that he reflected upon as a criminal defense attorney in terms of whether he should do it, but he ultimately decided that he needed to do it because it was in the best interest of his country. In other words, that's what he was supposed to do. That's what he had a duty to do. And despite the fact that he may have had strong passions, and I'm sure did, as then, you know, became a future president of the United States, he felt it was his duty to defend people. There are people who are, you know, in our profession who defend people who are accused of all kinds of heinous things, people who are, you know, white supremacists and things like that. People defend people accused of crimes. Defense attorneys do that because that is their job and that is what the Constitution requires that they do with all of their vigor and with all of their might, within all ethical and legal bounds of the law, of course. So, you know, this is a charge that has been leveled against different politicians and people in positions of power who used to be criminal defense attorneys. And I think it's extremely unfair. Because if we don't have a system where we have criminal defense attorneys who are representing clients and rather we just have prosecutors, that's going to be a one-sided system. And I think most prosecutors understand that. And most defense attorneys understand that. It's not a popular position to be in. It's not a popular thing to do to defend somebody who's accused of a crime. A, because lots of people think that if where there's smoke, there's fire. If somebody has committed some type of offense, and they must be guilty of it. If somebody has done something, they must have done something wrong in order to get arrested. Well, that's not always the case. And even if it is the case, they're guaranteed the right to a lawyer and the right to a defense. And we've had many examples of these things over the years. Even people who did something, even people who confessed to it, even people who said, I'm guilty, I want to plead guilty, they have the right to have a lawyer and they have to have their story told. It's part and parcel of our system of justice. And I think it is an unfair and unwarranted attack
to stand up and say, well, because somebody represented somebody accused of a crime, accused of an unpopular crime, and certainly of something that society finds rightly as reprehensible, that being child molestation. Nobody likes child molestation. The question is then, do we just let the system run roughshod and we let innocent people get convicted of something that they didn't do? And that's what you'd have, is if you'd set up a system where you discouraged defense attorneys from representing people accused of unpopular crimes. And I should say, what's a popular crime versus an unpopular crime? I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. But certainly, sexual assault of a child falls under that category. So what happens then the next time that somebody is falsely accused of a crime? And they don't have an attorney, or they don't have adequate representation, and they sit in jail. There is this principle that's been talked about, and there are variations on this quote. Would you rather let 1,000 guilty people go free, or incarcerate one innocent person? And the answer that's at the foundation of our criminal justice system is you'd protect that one innocent person, even if it meant letting some guilty people go free. The reason for that is because we have the presumption of innocence in this country. The only presumption that we should be talking about here is the presumption of innocence. There is no presumption of guilt. There's a presumption of innocence. And as soon as we lose that, I think we really fall off as a society, and we fall into a very dangerous category. We fall into a lot of the countries who have unjust justice systems. And certainly ours is not perfect. I'm not arguing that. But completely unjust and tyrannical justice systems have, they don't have a presumption of innocence. And that would be a very scary place to be. I'm Casey Hoff. You've been listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday morning from 8 to 9 right here on 1330 WHBL. Have a wonderful weekend.